Well, the picture you see behind me is a friend of mine. His name is Warren Mills, and he was the bloke, as they say in Australia, who brought me out to Australia. And Warren, in his own words, is a petrol head. And of course, what's a petrol head? We don't call that in the United States. He's a mechanic. And his father was a mechanic, and he was a mechanic. He actually went to work in the auto industry. And he built his own race car at one point. And when he retired, he thought, what am I going to do with my time? He decided he wanted to write books. He also was born into a Christian home. And throughout his life has continued to, figure out how to be a Christian in all the different phases. And so he was born into a Brethren household. For a while, he was in a Pentecostal church. For a while, in a Baptist church. He went out and spent some time in Europe in Labrie with Francis Schaeffer. Currently, he's attending in an Anglican, a high Anglican church. So he's been all over the place. But the first book he wrote, which he hasn't published, and he's reworking actually, is about Big Daddy Don Garlitz, who's sort of the founder of drag racing, because he's a petrol head. But the second book he wrote, which he actually did manage to get published, and is a book called How Good is the Golden Rule? Because all of his thinking about the Christian life, Warren is now in his 70s, and he actually joined our men's group this past week. All of the thinking about the Christian life, one of the things that he came down to was, first of all, pastors sometimes make things too complicated, he tells me. He says, if you really want to think about the Christian life, practice the golden rule. Just start there. And, to my defense, his book is a little bit fat. I've got it on the front chair right there. But practice the golden rule. Now, I can see it's switching back of me, and it's still, there it goes. All right. This is the text. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Which of you, if your son asks, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Now what's interesting is that you'll notice that the golden rule is very deeply tied to what comes before it. Part of the reason we know that is because, as we've seen, the structure of the Sermon on the Mount is this sort of circular structure, and we're right back here into the middle. And if you look at the text of the sermon, you'll see that, in fact, this is a really big, there it goes, for this sums up the law and the prophets, actually connects us back up with chapter 5, with, do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. And scholars look at these little tells in the text to find the structure of the text, to find the structure of the argument. So even though some of your newer translations might, modern editors insert paragraph headers to different places, the golden rule actually belongs tightly with the ask and it will be given. Knock and the door will be open. Seek and you will find. That's the context of the golden rule. Now, right away, people are seriously skeptical about ask and it will be given. Many people are prayer skeptics. They say praying is just talking to yourself. It's just wishful thinking. If there's no God up there, then praying is of absolutely no value. And they'll say, look, it doesn't work. I ask for things. I even ask for good things. I even ask for things that it would seem any divine mind guiding the universe could work history around or work to avoid. We think of the tragedy that happened with that Lily has shared us about. Other people have said, could God not have worked history around World War II? I mean, those kinds of prayers, it would seem, God should answer. Yet at the same time, people who are very skeptical about prayer actually get very positive about a whole bunch of ideas. Often I hear, well, the power of positive thinking, or the law of attraction, or name it and claim it. A lot of people imagine that, well, if I just keep my mind a certain way, then I will sort of attract to me the good things that I want. Now, another funny thing about this prayer passage is that it doesn't never work. If you talk to Christians, they will tell you about their belief in the power of prayer. They will talk to you about praying and asking for God to meet their needs, and in some seemingly miraculous way, He does. So on one hand, people are skeptical because they say, I prayed and it didn't work, while other people will say, I prayed and in fact, God did hear my prayer and He was looking out for me. So even though people express a lot of skepticism, it's really hard to completely deny it as well. And I think this expresses what we actually truly want. Because what we really want out of this is power. We want the power to shape the events of our life and the events of the world according to the way we see fit. Now, after C.S. Lewis died, one of his secretaries, Walter Hooper, accumulated a whole bunch of the various essays and articles that he had written, and he put it into a volume entitled God in the Dock. And in that little book, chapter 11 is a chapter on work and prayer. And Lewis begins the chapter noting what was, in many cases, the deistic argument, which historically was more popular before contemporary skepticism, which basically said, hey, if God is running the universe, why would He take input from us? Because God is obviously smarter, God is obviously greater, God sees outside of time. It would be silly to listen to us input in terms of how He should administer the world. Lewis went further into there to talk about the fact that what we're basically talking about with prayer and making requests is causality. And Lewis writes this: in every action, just as in every prayer, you are trying to bring about a certain result. And this result must be good or bad. Why then do we not argue, as the opponents of prayer argue, and say that if the intended result is good, God would bring it to pass without our interference? And if it is bad, He will prevent it happening whatever you do. Why wash your hands? If God intends them to be clean, they'll come clean without your washing them. And if He doesn't, they'll remain dirty, as Lady Macbeth found. However much soap you use, why ask for salt? Why put on your boots? Why do anything? In other words, if you think for a minute that, well, God doesn't need my input in running the universe, you give your input into running the universe every day. When you wash your hands, when you get out of bed, when you go to work, when you spend your money here or do something over there, you're changing the world. And so this real clear distinction between work and prayer isn't really anywhere near as clear as skeptics or deists imagine it would be. Now, Lewis goes on. Pascal says that God instituted prayer in order to allow His creatures the dignity of causality. It would perhaps be truer to say that He invented both prayer and physical action for that purpose. He gave us, small creatures, the dignity of being able to contribute to the course of events in two different ways. He made the matter of the universe such that we can, in those limits, do things to it. And that is why we wash our own hands and feed or murder our fellow creatures. Similarly, He made his own plan or plot of history such that it admits certain amounts of free play and can be modified in response to our prayers, just like history is modified in response to our actions. It would be foolish and imprudent to ask for a victory in war on the grounds that God might expect to know best. It would be equally foolish and imprudent to put on a Macintosh, which he's a Brit, so that's a coat. Does God not know best when you ought to be wet or dry? Two methods by which we are allowed to produce events might be called work and prayer, but are alike in this respect, that in both we try to produce a state of affairs which God has not, or at any rate has not yet, seen fit to provide so far, you know, on his own. And from this point of view, the old maxim, labore et ore, work is prayer, takes on a new meaning. What we do when we weed a field is not quite different from what we do when we pray for a good harvest. But there is an important difference all the same. You cannot be sure of a good harvest whatever you do to the field. But you can be sure that if you pull up one weed, that one weed will no longer be there. You can be sure that if you drink more than a certain amount of alcohol, you will ruin your health. Or that you go on for a few centuries more, wasting the resources of the planet on wars and luxuries, you will shorten the life of the whole human race. The kind of causality we exercise by work is, so to speak, divinely guaranteed and therefore ruthless. By it, we are free to do ourselves as much harm as we please. But the kind which we exercise by prayer is not like that. God has left himself a discretionary power. Had he not done so, prayer would have been an activity too dangerous for us. And we would have the horrible state of things envisioned by Juvenal, enormous prayers which heaven in anger grants. In other words, let's imagine for a minute that prayer worked as we want it to work. Well, just think that through for a minute. Well, I want it to be sunny all the time. What would the farmers do? Well, I want it to rain a certain amount. How about when? Well, I want to have this amount of money, or I want this job. You've probably done somebody else. In other words, if in fact prayer worked the way we often expect or even insist it would, well, probably the only one to have that power of prayer I would want would be me, and none of you would want me with that power. Because what are we going to do with Paul? And in fact, if there was one person in the world that had that kind of power, we would probably kill them because we wouldn't trust them enough to have that kind of power. Now, this doesn't really solve the initial dilemma fully of trust. Because, well, the verse goes on. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? Yet, we know children grow hungry all the time. And worse. We're still able to blame God for not preventing the pain and the suffering that we see. And then the verse even goes further. If you then, though you are evil... Now, since I've been on YouTube, I can't tell you how many people, when they hear this verse, are offended. Because they say, God is calling me evil? Surely if I were the manager of the world, there'd be no wars. Except if I heard that there was maybe a Nazi who was exterminating the Jews, then we'd have a war. Oh, okay. Or there'd be no hunger. But would there be obesity? Everyone would get what they wanted. Well, then we're back to the situation I was talking about before. You see, what really is at the heart of this issue is that we think we know best. And there's a certain demand in our heart that the universe run according to our preferences. Now, Anyone who thinks this way should read history. Because if there's one thing you learn reading history, it's that people at different times through the world have thought, we know how the world should be run. All of sorts of ideas. This is the way the world should be run. Where later generations will look back upon them with judgment and say, no, they were wrong. They were wrong for doing this. They were wrong for allowing that. Leading to the idea that we here right now are the pinnacle of morality and know what is right. Do you think 50 years from now, they're not going to think that about us? And we don't even know the aspects of our lives they will stand in judgment upon us for. And this brings us to the golden rule. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Now, many have noted that the golden rule itself is found in many different cultures. You can find a version of it in Confucius. You can find a version of it in Judaism. You can find a version of it just about anywhere. And sometimes it's called the law of reciprocity. And it's really pretty simple. Once as a kid you realize that others might hit you or hit you back, you stop hitting. Because you realize, well, if I do bad to them, they might do bad to me. Maybe if I do good to them, they'll do good to me. And so very quickly we learn this in human relationships. And so the golden rule doesn't sound like some mysterious thing out of heaven. But here's the question. If you attach it to all of the skeptical thoughts that we've had with ask and it will be given. If your son asks for a fish, will you give him a stone? All of the complaints against God, in a sense, here in this verse, God says, okay, maybe I'm not granting you agency over everything in the world to have prayer work the way you would imagine. But you do have agency with your own words, with your own hands, with your own actions. If you think I'm not managing the world well, show me how you manage your own life, and I'm going to give you the simplest, most obvious rule and moral standard to operate with. Show me how well you do. And this is where we actually tie into last week's verse, because here's the dynamic. If you go to prison and you ask a prisoner, most of the prisoners will tell you what about their incarceration? I'm innocent. Oh, okay. Or at least I'm not as guilty as that guy. Okay. Or at least I didn't do this. Okay. This is how we work. We all think, psychologists have names for it, it's called bias. We're all biased towards ourselves. The things that I've done wrong were justified because of the hard life I had growing up, of the injustices done to me, of the fact that other people are getting away with worse things, and so me taking this little thing, that doesn't alter the universe at all. Just ask your neighbor about whether or not you are treating your neighbor the way you would want to be treated. Is your judgmental attitude towards God uniquely? Or, in fact, is this attitude that you have about prayer and God's management of the universe simply a reflection of your attitude in general and my attitude in general? This self-serving bias that we walk around with, we just project it up to God. If I were in charge of the world, yet nobody around you would trust you being in charge of the world. This world is filled with the wrong kind of people who you would condemn. This world is filled with attitudes against you that you don't approve of. This world is filled with all sorts of things that you would undo that others, in fact, would want to do. In fact, the truth is, well, Pete's been battling a superbug. Where did we get superbugs from? Antibiotics. Aren't antibiotics good? Absolutely. I'm really grateful we have antibiotics, but antibiotics produce superbugs. We have climate change. What is climate change the result of? All those little internal combustion engines, all of the concrete that we do. In fact, many of the problems we have are the results of previous solutions to other problems that we have. And yet, we imagine this fix will fix everything. Ask around. So Warren says, try this. Try the golden rule. Go ahead and judge God if you want, or decide not to believe, or act as if he's not there. God can take it. That much is obvious. You practice the golden rule in all of your affairs. It struck me when I was making this sermon, Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. One of his little rules is this: set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. Why? Because most of what we hear is everybody's complaints. What you might learn if you practice the golden rule is this: that giving people what they say they want and loving them are sometimes two very different things. You learn that if you're dealing with children. Children will tell you what they think they want, and you as a parent will say, I'm going to give you this instead. Notice the illustration Jesus gives. God exercises wisdom in giving us what we need. That many of the sufferings we are subject to are partially self-inflicted and the product of the use of our own agency already. Go ahead and give someone everything they say they want. Notice what that does to a person over years and decades. Notice how so often the most generous, loving, giving people have, in fact, suffered hardship. And the most self-centered, self-indulgent people are often those who have never suffered anything in their life. They don't know what suffering is. Empathy is really hard for them. But those who have striven and suffered can sometimes be wells of human mercy. That many of our problems are the direct result of past attempts to make our dreams come true. One of the things that you realize as a minister is that marriage is hard. Why? Well, you can learn that in your own marriage, or you can listen to probably the number one thing people complain to their pastor about because they have nobody else to hear it, which is their spouse. And it's certainly ironic in our culture that the person that they are complaining about is the exact same person that they stood up with and all of their friends and chose themselves in our culture and pledged undying love for. That'll give us a little indication of what good managers of the universe we are when we can't even manage ourselves for decades. Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that some of the interesting comedies coming up have been afterlife comedies. The Good Place was on television for a while. Upload was something that's on Amazon streaming. And what's interesting about this is that these shows are all about designing heaven. And what all of these shows pretty reliably bump into is that people can't do it. When we create a place where we think we get everything we want, we're not happy with it. We're not happy with ourselves. We're really bad managers of the world. Skepticism about whether, with unlimited power, we could create for ourselves a world in which we would achieve what our hearts long for. Hollywood writers basically are saying, no, I don't want to spoil the finale of The Good Place, but that's really what that finale is about. And it was Augustine who many years ago said, our hearts are restless until we find our rest in thee, meaning God. Now, Ask and it shall be given. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus brings his disciples to the mountain. And Jesus knows what is coming. And he asks his Father, if this cup may pass from him, can he do so? Now, people have lots of excuses why prayers are not necessarily granted. Maybe you have sin in your life. Jesus had none. Maybe it's against God's will. Jesus' will was one with the Father. Maybe you don't have enough faith. Who had more faith than Jesus, who could still the storm and raise the dead and recover sight to the blind? If Jesus could pray a prayer and it would be denied, and what would be deniable about avoiding an unjust trial and execution? But he was denied. Why? For us. The Father even said no to the Son. A scorpion? A snake? A crucifixion? It was for us that the Father said no. So, Warren's book. If you practice it, you will learn you're not good at it. That's the funny thing about the Golden Rule. Go ahead. Practice it. Actually, Warren in his book combines it with the Great Commandment, which is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Go ahead and do it. And what you will discover is that you're really bad at it. That loving is hard, that you don't always know what to say or what to do or how to respond, that even sometimes just doing what that person thinks they want for the moment is in fact not loving at all. That love sometimes means saying no. That love sometimes means saying no to this person so you can say yes to these people. That managing the world is very, very difficult. And so Warren's challenge is, right, go ahead and practice that golden rule. But do so out of gratitude. Because then there's a freedom to it. Otherwise, it's, I have to practice the golden rule, and you very quickly become a slave to it. You can't save the world. You can't save the world through prayer. You can't save the world through your actions. You can only respond to it being saved by someone who is capable. And on the way of practicing this little rule, what you will discover is, in fact, transformation. That God will give you the opportunity to not only save with your mind or your words or your hands or whatever, to participate in the moving of the world towards its conclusion, but also with your prayers. And that you yourself would be transformed. Because actually, that's what's happening. And we are in fact being transformed for the life to come. Let's pray. Lord, so often we don't even know what we need or know what we want. And so you give us this wide open invitation, one which we know by Christ's example, won't always work in the way we imagine we want it to. But yet you tell us, go ahead, ask for anything. Knock. Even if we are evil, you will give us good things. And yet hard things come into our lives one day after the next. Help us to believe, Lord, that you, in fact, are good and trustworthy. And that even when difficult things come, that we are given complete license to pray against, that you will be with us. And you will take these sufferings and these losses and turn them into greater glory. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen.